her greatest hope against the threat of nuclear war is Superman. The greatest threat to Superman.
What are you up to?
Is Lex Luthor. He's created the ultimate weapon to destroy the Man of Steel.
Is that adorable?
Superman 4.
Dude of Steel. Where are you gonna get it?
His most important adventure, The Quest for Peace. Rated PG.
Hello, and welcome to Unloved Sequels, the podcast that brings you a blow-by-blow critique of Hollywood's worst-rated sequels. You know, the ones that some people think should never have been made. We're your hosts. Michael, say hello.
Hello!
And I'm Claire. In this episode, we're cutting the budget and letting the star take creative control as we single-handedly, or is that ham-fistedly, tackle the ongoing threat of nuclear war. Michael, what's the movie?
So this time, we're in search of peace. Yes, Claire, that's something that the world could do right now with. But something the world could done without is Superman 4, The Quest for Peace.
Oh, yay. No, Claire. Yeah, I'm really excited for this episode.
Oh, geez.
I like this episode. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh,
I'm looking forward to it.
This breaks my little DC heart, this film does. There is some shining light. So, Superman 4 opened on July the 24th, 1987, and went on to gross $36.7 million against a budget of $17 million, not including advertising. So, it took back its budget and probably covered its advertising costs, but probably didn't take grossing.
Didn't actually make any money.
Yes. Just for comparison, Superman opened in 1979 with a budget of $55 million. And went on to make $300.5 million.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Superman 2 opened in 1981 and was made with a budget of $54 million and went on to make $190.4 million. Superman 3 was released in 1983 and was made with a budget of $39 million and went on to make $80.2 million. So,
I mean, there's a trend forming.
Now, between Superman 3 and Superman 4, they also made Supergirl the movie.
They did.
What is a part of
Although you wouldn't know it from watching this movie.
No. They're like, meh. That opened in 1984 with a budget of $35 million, only grossed $14.3 million. That's the biggest flop in this franchise. It didn't even make back its budget. It was a complete, utter bomb. So obviously, with all that into consideration, they went into this film going, right, these aren't making this money. Let's make the budget smaller. If we have the smaller budget, we'll turn some kind of profit. So they obviously took that into consideration. In the US and Canada, it opened in 1,511 theaters, grossing $5.6 million during its opening weekend, ranking fourth at the box office for that week. Well, it's not good for a superhero movie back then. Don't forget, we didn't have movies every single week back then like we have now.
That's true. They were a box office draw.
So like now when a superhero movie comes out, people are shocked that it flopped. Back then, it probably would even a bigger shock that it flopped because they weren't around very much. In the UK, it opened in 234 screens. What is kind of average for the UK? Because the UK is a tiny, tiny country compared to the US.
Yeah.
It grossed 508,000. What is about 0.8 million back then, so it's just under 1 million for the weekend, becoming number one film in the UK for that weekend. But it failed to retain that number one spot for the week, grossing 987.5 compared to The Living Daylights that took £1 million that week, which had already been out since the release, its release on the 29th of June.
Oh, so that then came back up the charts.
No, it was just hovering there the whole time. It wasn't at, it didn't never left the charts. That whole month, it was just making money.
Oh, well, good for them,
UK audience. Well, it's the UK. UK cannot get enough James Bond, can they?
This is true. We do love a Bond movie.
So they're going to make money for them. So, top 10 grossing worldwide movies of 1987. At number 10, we have The Untouchables. Number 9, we have Moonstruck, that I've never seen.
Well, I like that film. Have you
never seen it? That's Cher, isn't it, Nicolas Cage?
Yeah,
I've never seen it.
I think that's the one she got an Oscar for.
I think it is, and she also got one about the factory, which was in with Meryl Streep. Did you get one for that one? I don't know. I don't know.
But Moonstruck is very good, and she is very good in it.
Number 8, we have Predator. Number 7, we have Lethal Weapon. Number 6, we have Good Morning Vietnam, that I say every time I test my microphone out before I record an episode of Our Love Sequels. That's how I use my connection.
Such a nerd.
Number 5, we have Three Men and a Baby. Number 4, we have The Living Daylights. Number 3, we have Dirty Dancing. Number 2, we have Beverly Hills Cop 2. And number 1, we have Fatal Attraction.
Of course. Well, that's a good chart.
That is a really good chart. It's a good, strong chart. One sequel.
You can see why this film isn't in it.
Yes. So Superman 4 ended its theatrical run at number 31 in the 1987 box office, just behind a classic of mine and a classic of yours, Mannequin, with Kim Cattrall.
Oh, I like that film.
I do like that film. We should do Mannequin 2 one day. Maybe next year.
Maybe we will.
Maybe next year we can do Mannequin 2, maybe around Valentine's. That'd be a good one, wouldn't it? Maybe we'll start the year off with it. Maybe. That'd be a good one to start one off. Ooh. So other great movies released that year. There's some good movies in this list as well. So these didn't hit the top 10, but they're still really strong contenders. The Witches of Eastwick, The Secret of My Success, RoboCop, Planes, Trains and Automobiles, A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3, Wall Street, Batteries Not Included, The Lost Boys, my favourite vampire movie.
Yeah.
One of Claire's favourite movies, Overboard, Baby Boom, Empire of the Sun, and one of our household guilty pleasures in my household, don't know about Claire's, but Masters of the Universe!
Yeah, I think that's a guilty pleasure for anyone of our generation, isn't it? If you're in your early 40s, probably mid-40s, and maybe even late 40s, you were of the age to watch Masters of the Universe when you were a kid.
I freaking loved that film. But no one would know. Our parents took us to go and see it in the cinema. That's why that flopped. But when it came out on VHS, I think we all went and watched it on VHS. We all rented it 1,000 times. So, yes. So Superman 4, The Quest for Peace, sits at 669 in the worldwide sequels box office. It has a 90-minute runtime. Range Rotten Tomatoes scores, critics is 10%, and audience is 16%.
Ooh.
That's a kick in the nuts, isn't it?
Oh, you want a bit of Savlon on that burn.
Oh, yeah. So, Claire, do you have any behind-the-scenes stuff for us?
I do. I'm still reeling slightly from that 10% Rotten Tomatoes. That's harsh. So,
are you going to now spend the next fortnight just making fake Rotten Tomato scores just to get the score up?
I don't have time for that. But yes, I'm going to ignore my children and my job for the next month
to try and
skew that rating back up. So cast and creative team on this movie. We've got a few returners. We've got Christopher Reeve back for his fourth turn as Superman and Clark Kent. We have Gene Hackman back in the franchise. Notable in his absence, we commented on this when we did our Superman 3 episode. Was that earlier this year or was it last year? I don't remember. But if you haven't listened to that one, have a listen. One of our issues with Superman 3 was the lack of Gene Hackman. He is back for this movie playing Lex Luthor. He also provides the voice of Nuclear Man for reasons that no one quite understands. Maybe Mark Pillow has a really squeaky voice or something. So they thought, let's just dub him. I don't think Mark Pillow knew he was being dubbed either. I think it was one of those situations. It was a bit of a Darth Vader situation. We've got Margot Kidder back as Lois Lane. We've got Jackie Cooper back as Perry White and Mark McClure as Jimmy Olsen. In terms of new additions to the cast, we've got John Cryer in as Lenny, who is Lex Luthor's nephew. Sam Wanamaker. You don't like him? I quite like him. I think he serves a function and he does that well, maybe. No, we'll talk about that.
Okay.
Sam Wanamaker in as David Warfield. Mark Pillow, as I mentioned, playing Nuclear Man, but dubbed by Gene Hackman. Mario Hemingway as Lacey Warfield. And for the eagle-eyed amongst us, we have an early movie appearance from Jim Broadbent as one of the arms dealers. Jean-Pierre Dubois, apparently. Ah, yeah. He's, you know, when Gene Hackman's talking to the three arms dealers, I think they're only in two scenes, one quite early on and one later on when he says, I'm taking over the company. Yeah. Or I'm taking, you're like, you're fired kind of thing. And one of the guys is Jim Broadbent with a shaved head, which is really weird.
That is weird.
I don't think I've ever seen him not as an older gentleman, I guess. I don't think I've seen any of his younger performances.
That's been 80 for the last 50 years.
Yes.
Like Maggie Smith.
Yeah.
You just see him as a grandson.
Yeah. So yes, he's in this, a relatively young Jim Broadbent is in this movie in a very small role. The movie is directed by Sidney J. Fury, who has quite a few directing credits to his name, including the Cliff Richard movie, The Young Ones, The Ipcress File in 1965, Lady Sings the Blues. He's uncredited as director for The Jazz Singer in 1980. I don't know who the credited director. I didn't dive quite that deeply into it. I guess he did a bit of redirection or something.
Yeah.
And he's uncredited on that. We've also got Christopher Reeve credited as second unit director on this movie. He's not the only second unit director, but he is one of the second unit directors on this movie.
Yeah.
Writing credits. Obviously, we have credits for Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster for their character of Superman, but they haven't actively written on the movie. The story credit is Christopher Reeve. This is his only writing credit besides one episode of The Practice from 2003. And then also story credits and the screenplay credits go to Lawrence Connor and Mark Rosenthal, who also worked together on The Jewel of the Nile, Star Trek IV, The Undiscovered Country, Beverly Hillbillies, Planet of the Apes in 2001, Mona Lisa Smile. They've worked together quite extensively. Mm. They have quite a lot of credits on IMDb as writers. Music, we have John Williams is back. You will recall again from Superman 3 that his theme was used, but he did not do any additional work on that movie. He did for this movie. And then there was also score adaptation, and it was conducted by Alexander Courage, who had done some additional orchestration on Superman, also for Star Wars Episode 4, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. You see he's connected to John Williams. And also he's worked on loads of non-John Williams titles as well.
I think the track on this is absolutely great. I think it's a really strong, you know, if you can hear it different from the original. There's some different instrumental changes, but I think it's a great score. You know, you can't go wrong with it. It's a classic. It's up there with Star Wars.
Exactly. It's like a warm bowl of soup, isn't it, when you hear the Superman theme? It's very comforting and very familiar. It's nice. And then my husband comes along and starts singing Indiana Jones over the top of it just to wind me up. Well, because we discussed before, or maybe it was when we were talking about Indiana Jones, or maybe we haven't done a Star Wars installment yet, so it wouldn't have been that. But the fact that they're all quite interchangeable, you can sing one over the other, and it's my husband's favourite thing to do is when he hears one of the John Williams themes, is to sing another one over the top of it.
That just hurts my head when people do that. I just get really calm.
Yeah.
Brain fog. I'm like, what are you doing? Do it!
Or he'll, you know, I'll start singing one and he'll say, switch to Indiana Jones. Switch to Star Wars. Switch to E.T. E.T. is quite easy to do, actually. Those are the three that are most interchangeable.
What's E.T.?
Superman, Star Wars. Do.
Oh, yeah. Do Jaws. See, that didn't work.
You just wanted to hear me sing, didn't you?
Oh, you can hold a key. I can't, so it's quite a rarity.
Anyway.
Yes.
On to production information for this movie. So Alexander Salkind and his son Ilya, you may recall from the Superman 3 episode, they were producers of the Superman series. They had originally planned to produce a fourth installment if Superman 3 had grossed at least $40 million. The film had a negative reaction overall, but it did gross $80.2 million. So they were considering a fourth installment. But Christopher Reeve was hesitant to come back to the series as Superman. He had originally, he was supposed to be doing a cameo as Superman in the Supergirl movie, but he pulled out of doing that. But the Salkinds were determined that they wanted to make a fourth movie. So they started to make plans. They announced it. And then Supergirl flopped. And Santa Claus the Movie also flopped, which was another one of their movies. I can't believe Santa Claus the Movie was a flop. It's a classic as far as I'm concerned. But at the time...
I think it's like another Master of the Universe. We all didn't go and see it in the cinema, but we all rented it on VHS.
We watch it. Yeah, everyone our age watches that movie every Christmas.
It's the only thing
that was
like
no good to the Salkinds at the time. It's brilliant. But they were under financial strain then off the back of those two financial failures. So they were humming and hawing about actually, did they want to take the risk with a fourth Superman movie? Yep. So they then sold the franchise rights to Menahem Golan and Yoram Globus of the Cannon Group for $5 million in June 1985. The studio then persuaded Christopher Reeve to return by offering him $6 million as his salary for the movie, plus financing for a project that he wanted to work on called Street Smart. And he got storyline approval and director approval. So he came back into this movie with quite a lot of chips in his hand.
Yeah.
Richard Donner, who we will remember directed the first Superman movie, started directing the second movie, got fired partway through in favour of Richard Lester.
Yep.
Donner was originally, he'd originally intended to make at least four Superman films. That had been his original plan before he started even on the first one. So he was approached to direct Superman 4, The Quest for Peace. It's slightly unclear whether he was interested in doing it or not, but as it happened, he was already working on Lethal Weapon. So he didn't have time to make it at the time the studio wanted to make it. So he wrote back to them and politely declined, but it's unclear whether he would have accepted had he been available.
So he's still according to number seven at the box office chart that year. And then
he made a good choice.
He made a good choice. Why choice?
Well,
why
done
choice?
Richard Donner.
Yeah.
Richard Lester, in his biography, it's claimed that he was also offered the chance to direct Superman 4 and also declined. We don't know which one of the two Richards was offered first, Richard Donner or Richard Lester, but apparently they were both asked. They both said no. Wes Craven was set to direct the movie, but he was then replaced after creative differences with Christopher Reeve, because of course he'd been given director approval. Christopher Reeve suggested Ron Howard, but he was unavailable because he was in pre-production on Willow. So that's how we ended up with Sidney J. Fury, who I'm still not sure Christopher Reeve was particularly happy with. I think they still had a fairly fraught working relationship, but there's a point at which you just have to go, well, someone's got to make their movie. So
you're going towards that director. You're kind of like going towards the bottom of your list already. You know, they've like resourced all the A-list that would work for a certain budget. Anybody above them is too expensive. Anybody below them is like, So I'd love to see a Wes Craven Superman, though. That would
That would have been good, wouldn't it?
As
you kind of mentioned briefly earlier, the budget for this movie was slashed quite heavily. The original budget was going to be $36 million. So they essentially halved it to $17 million because having, I guess, spent $5 million on the rights for the movie and $6 million on Superman, on getting Christopher Reeve back to play Superman, plus his choice of director, plus whatever money
that,
he wanted for his
million
other movie.
Would have included his $6 million.
Yeah, that's true. But they decided they were not prepared to invest $36 million in the movie. That I think they were starting to experience financial issues by that point. So they cut some corners. They reused some special effects. I think if you look closely, maybe all of Superman's flying scenes. There are certainly some of Superman's flying scenes are duplicates and they've just changed the background on the blue screen.
Yeah,
but Superman's positioning is exactly the same. They've and to be fair, this is not a new concept. Disney have been doing this for decades. There's, you know, very famously some stills of, I think it's one of the early Winnie the Pooh movies where Christopher Robin is basically a rehash of Mowgli from Jungle Book. You can put the clips side by side and you see the characters moving exactly the same way. Even more recently, I think in Moana, is it? There's a bit where she sits up in bed and she's got crazy hair. And that's basically been redrawn over Anna from Frozen doing exactly the same thing in that movie. So that, you know, this is not a new concept to kind of reuse things in this way, but maybe it's not so much done in live action movies as it is in animation. So a lot of Christopher Reeve and Sidney J. Fury's ideas were changed by Cannon Group to keep the budget as low as they could, which meant that the movie was actually quite different and arguably quite worse, if that's a correct use of grammar, than they had been intending. So Christopher Reeve, in his autobiography Still Me, he made a comparison between how the Cannon Group worked to how Richard Donner would have done the same kind of thing. He talks about particularly the scene where Superman goes to the UN building to give a speech. And he writes, if that had been a scene in Superman 1, we would have actually shot it on 42nd Street. Dick Donner would have choreographed hundreds of pedestrians and vehicles and cut to people gawking out of office windows at the sight of Superman walking down the street like the Pied Piper. Instead, we had to shoot at an industrial park in England in the rain with about 100 extras, not a car in sight, and a dozen pigeons thrown in for atmosphere. Even if the story had been brilliant, I don't think we could ever have lived up to the audience expectations with this approach. So he was like fairly scathing.
Yeah, but that's just because that's the one part of the film he wasn't in charge of. Like, if you can't blame the script because he wrote the script. You can't blame all the decisions because he was part of the decisions. So he's picking on the one thing that he had no control of.
Yes, that is quite possibly true. So the Cannon Group thought that they had potentially a blockbuster on their hands. So they cut the original cut was 2 hours plus on this movie. Yeah. But as you said, they cut it down to 90 odd minutes. Two reasons. One, so that movie theatres could have more screenings in a day and generate more income, which would then make more money for the theatres and make more money for the studio. And then also they were at one point were considering using the cut footage to make the next sequel, which we know never happened. But that had been their kind of thinking behind cutting, because actually what they cut was kind of huge chunks of subplot that they could have then recycled into another movie. One of the bits that they cut was that originally there were two nuclear men in the movie. The nuclear man that we see in the movie was the second nuclear man. There was a previous prototype who was played by Clive Mantle, who I think American audiences probably won't recognize that name, but
I don't recognize that name.
People of our generation and older will know Clive Mantle. Clive Mantle was Dishy Dr. Mike in Casualty in the 90s. No, blank face. All the mums fancied him. So he's quite well known to TV audiences in the UK, but is not a name particularly in movies. So the character was a kind of original prototype who then got defeated by Superman, but left behind some sort of protoplasm that then was attached with the hair to the nuclear warhead that was thrown into the sun and creating the nuclear man that we see in the movie.
Right.
But that all got cut. Now, we talked a little bit about Christopher Reeve having so many chips on the table for this movie. Potentially, there may have been some slight ego issues as a result of this. According to Margot Kidder, Christopher Reeve and Sidney J. Fury did not get along. Right. She and Christopher Reeve did not particularly get along during filming of this movie. Mark Pillow found him a bit tricky. Mark Pillow did say that he got on very well with Gene Hackman and enjoyed working with him, but he found Christopher Reeve to be a bit intense. I mean, Kidder's theory on it was that Reeve's ego was just inflated by having the co-writer credit on the movie and having so much creative control. Christopher Reeve, since making the movie, was very open about his regret for having made it. Again, looking at his autobiography, he wrote in one chapter, "The less said about Superman 4, the better." And then later on, I think a chapter or two later, "Superman 4 was a catastrophe from start to finish. That failure was a huge blow to my career." And basically between those two quotes and the one I gave you earlier about filming the UN in Milton Keynes, that's basically the sum total of what he has to say about Superman 4 in his 300-page autobiography. So he doesn't talk about it particularly fondly in that book. And yes, as I was saying, the Cannon Group had originally planned to make a fifth film. It was going to be directed by Albert Pyun, potentially using some of that cut footage from this movie, but Canon instead went bankrupt. I don't think directly because of this movie, but this movie clearly didn't save it from the financial problems they were already having.
No.
When that happened, the film rights reverted back to Ilya and Alexander Salkind, who then sold the rights to Warner Brothers in 1993. And then nothing happened with the franchise until 2006, I think, was when we had Man of Steel.
No, we had Superman Returns in between.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Well, then 2006 must have been Superman Returns. The next installment was, because ironically, he says to Lex Luthor, see you in 20. And it was about 20 years. It was 19 years before the next Superman movie came out.
Because this actual movie, Superman Returns, is a sequel to Superman 2.
Who?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It ignores this movie and it ignores...
And three.
And goes straight. Yes. As it tries to reboot it. Well, one day we'll cover, but I don't really want to talk about Kevin Spacey that much, so that's probably why we haven't
covered. Yeah. Yeah, well, we'll put a pin in that for now.
Yeah, we will.
So, yes. So, on to the movie itself, Michael.
Yes.
How did you find it? Had you seen this movie before? Remind me, I can't remember.
So this is like another one of those movies that I own and have always owned because I own the other three in the franchise. That's one of those things like I need to own it. It comes in a box.
So you just want it to look nice on the shelf.
Yes. And I've put it on a lot and then never finished it. This was the first time that I think I actually finished it due to recognition. I think it's the first time I actually watched it all the way through. Superman 1 and 2 are two of my favourite comic book movies. I think they're great. I don't think they've even aged up dramatically. I think I think they just look like a good period piece of cinematic history. I think they're great. The cast is great. This film is a journey for me. And I think I struggle with it more because this came out in 1987. In 1989, we had Tim Burton's Batman came out. So while this was being released, Batman was in pre-production.
Yeah.
And they're like chalk and cheese.
Yes.
And I think that's quite a hard pill for me to swallow. And if they try taking a different direction to Superman in it, like they did with, like say for instance, between Batman Forever and Batman and Robin to Batman and Batman Returns, I know they're not people's cup of tea, but they were definitely trying to take a sidestep away from the other movies, trying to change the direction of it. With this movie, they weren't trying to change direction of it. They were just trying to have a cash grab.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of my problem with this movie lies. You like this movie, don't you?
I do. I have a bit of a soft spot for this movie, and I always have, and I don't know how many times I've seen it. I wondered, as I was making my notes for this, it occurred to me that potentially, bearing in mind that Superman 3 came out in 1983, this came out in 1987, so I was 7 years old when this came out in the movie theatre, I wouldn't have been taken to see it in the movie theatre, nor would I have seen any of the others, obviously, in the movie theatre, because I would have been too young. This might have been the first Superman movie that I saw and remembered. So potentially, I may have seen Superman 3 when I was maybe 4 years old, if it came onto TV, but I wouldn't remember that.
Yeah.
But this Superman 4, I'm sure as a family, we would have watched when it came onto TV. And so potentially, this is the first Superman movie that I was conscious of having seen, that I would remember having seen. So maybe that's why I have a bit of a soft spot for it. I mean, look, don't get me wrong. This is not a movie that I consciously and deliberately rewatch, but it is a movie I have seen prior to watching it for this more than once. I don't know how many times, but not a lot.
Out of all the Superman movies within that saga, this is the most family-friendly one, I would say.
Yeah, probably.
Because there isn't much about, you know, there is the flirting's dialed down quite a lot compared to the other movies, and the threat of Earth and earthquakes and things like that don't really happen because they didn't have the budget. So on paper, this would probably looks like the easiest one to show a family member. There's no kids in peril in this movie like there is in the other one. Like,
yeah.
There's no kids being kidnapped or anything. There's no robotic woman from Superman 3 that scared the shit out of me as a child. And still does when I watch it.
Yes.
There's just a blonde man with really long drag nails that's scratching him.
Yeah.
There's some
so, yeah, I have a soft spot for this movie. I always quite enjoy watching it. And I know it's cheesy. I know objectively there's plenty wrong with it.
So what do you not like about it while we're on that subject?
What do I not like?
Yes.
Because I've got more things that I do like.
No, let's go down the
But I can come back to those.
Come back to those.
Okay, well, look. The big issue with this movie is that the plot is somehow simultaneously convoluted and paper thin.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on, but none of it really goes anywhere.
None of it makes any sense. It's just kind of like, it's just like strung together some plot holes.
Yeah, there's a lot of strands, but they don't tie together. They don't really go anywhere. The entire subplot Sam Wanamaker's character is pointless. I mean, it's not. I mean, it's trying to be a social commentary, I think, is the issue, that it's a bit holier than thou. And so they bring in Sam Wanamaker as some kind of de facto Rupert Murdoch style sleazy shitball journalist who isn't interested in real journalism and is just sensationalising everything. And they do kind of use that to drive the plot in a couple of places. But
if you use that,
they could do that without it. And then by the end of the movie, they've thrown the whole thing back out the window and
like they could have just
Perry's back
that.
In charge.
Like they could have just resolved that. Gene Hackman gets out of prison and buys the Daily Planet and tries to control the news like Jonathan Pryce does in Tomorrow Never Dies.
Yes.
That makes sense.
That would have made more sense. That would have saved them from bringing in two new characters. And yes, I get they wanted to bring in a new female character as a love interest for Clark Kent, but they did that in Superman 3 and threw her away. They didn't, I can't remember, Lana.
Because that
was brought in as a love interest because they were giving Margot Kidder a lot less screen time.
Yes.
So they brought in the character of Lana as a love interest for Superman, Clark Kent. They could have kept her if they wanted a love interest, or they could have brought in the Lacey character just as a journalist, as a rookie journalist who starts off along that kind of sensationalist route and by the end has learned that real journalism is what's important. Now, they didn't need to have that whole subplot, and it was a big distraction.
I've got a question about this subplot, and you might be able to help me with it. So at the end,
I don't know.
The man goes, "Where is she?" And they go, and he goes, "Oh, I'm going to get him." I don't remember any. I might have just been looking at my phone, I'll be honest, or writing a note down. Is there a scene before that? Because there's a deleted scene, but there's a scene where Nuclear Man has interaction with Lacey. That's it.
I can help with this. I know the answer to this.
Okay.
This is part of the deleted subplot with the first Nuclear Man. So the first Nuclear Man developed a crush on the Lacey character.
Right.
And then because the protoplasm that was left behind after he was defeated by Superman were gross. Yes, maybe. I did. Anyway.
Nuclear Man whatever. One, pre-cum. Yeah, okay.
The leftovers of Nuclear Man were used to create Nuclear Man 2. And so that crush formed part of Nuclear Man 2's personality and character.
But is there a scene where Lacey and Nuclear Man 2, because I found it in the deleted scenes and I was like, well, that answers that. But in the movie, does Nuclear Man 2 have any interaction with Lacey before he kidnaps her?
No.
What the fuck? Why did they just leave that dialogue? That line didn't need to happen. She didn't need to be kidnapped.
No, it was completely orphaned by them removing that Nuclear Man 1
But there's a deleted
subplot.
Scene when she's in Gene Hackman's lair and she's like, I'm looking for Lex Luthor, I don't know. And he goes, I am Nuclear Man. I'm like, if you just kept that scene in, that would make sense. But I was like, they've never seen each other before.
No.
And I was like going, no, I've got my phone. Did I make
I
any
don't think
more
so. Well, unless I did as well. But my understanding from my research as well is that there's zero interaction between those two characters prior to him saying, where is she, and going off to kidnap her. That makes no sense. So this is the issue. There's so much going on, and then they take out bits and obviously haven't realised that the bits they're taking out make sense of some of the bits that they've left in. It's very clumsy is my issue.
Because there's also another really good deleted scene where Gene Hackman is, while Superman's trying to be distracted with fighting Nuclear Man, he's selling nuclear weapons to other people.
Mm.
It was really good. And I was like, why cut this out? One of the deleted scenes added up to like 10 minutes. I was like, you could have just left all this in for the sake of 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Because
obviously
I was a bit
not.
Like,
the studio clearly thought they knew what they were doing, but a lot of those cuts just made the movie make less sense.
Yes.
So, yes. Is there anything you would like to add to the list of things that we don't like about this movie?
Yeah, my list's quite long. Are you ready? I can just wheel them off.
It's all right. Quickly. I've still got my what I like list to come back to. I can kind
I've
of sweep
got
up your
thing
mess.
On my white one like my like list. Now, my main issue with this movie is the cast. It's been 4 years since the previous movie.
Yes.
And none of their relationships had grown in those 4 years. We're aware that it's been 4 years. We could have started this movie with a blossom in some form of relationship, even between Lois Lane and Clark Kent. But literally, there is no extension to the character. Like, it feels like it should be picked up like a week after certain number three ended.
Yeah. It's like they've been cryogenically frozen for 4 years and then defrosted for this movie.
Margaret has drunk about 15 litres of vodka, and it shows, because she looks about 90.
Yeah. Oh, harsh. That is harsh. But yes, she has aged more than 4 years in those four years, bless her.
Has. Just like the whole concept of this, I don't mind a bit of cheese in these movies, but like the whole prison break scene when they use the car to get the... And that, no, don't laugh, Claire. It's awful.
It's awful, but I like it.
It's overcrowded. There's a suicide scene where he just like... Oh, Lois Lane jumps off the building with him, and she's like, oh, it's not that bad. I'm like...
Yeah, that's weird. No, that is weird.
I'm just like, what's going on? Oh, it's not that bad. Oh, I'm jumping too, am I? And then by that point, she didn't know Superman existed. And then she did know, and then she didn't know. And then I just went like, what is going on? It was just a series of half-baked ideas that I had strung together and hoped that no one would pay any notice, that people just want to see Superman back on screen. John Cryer. Is
Lenny?
Awful in this movie. Yes. He's
no.
Awful.
No. No, I won't
he's
have
awful.
It.
He's awful in this movie. The only advantage is that he went on to play Lex Luthor in the Supergirl TV show. That's the only crowning
glory.
Well,
to be fair, he did that basically to atone for this movie. He is not particularly proud of his efforts in this movie. I don't mind it. I think he's that very kind of 80s teen thing that John Cryer did in the 80s. So
yeah, but it's just like, he's just so bad in it. He's just so bad. He's just like a 12-year-old playing an 18-year-old that's being a dick. And I'm just like, no, you know, like, if you want to see how that role should be played, look at, what's his name, Seth in Austin Powers.
Seth Green,
that's his name. Yeah. That's how that role should be played.
Yeah, maybe.
I found the whole dinner party scene with them running around in and out the elevators and stuff.
The double dates.
Oh, irritating. And a waste of time.
I like it. It's so silly.
Oh, it's so silly.
But Christopher Reeve, I think Christopher Reeve really shines in that scene, is the thing. I think he, particularly as Clark Kent, I mean, I think it's a shame for Clark Kent as a character, because he's basically made out to be a complete buffoon throughout this movie. And Clark Kent is more than that.
Yeah.
But he does. But particularly in this movie, there are certain scenes that exist just to make Clark Kent look stupid. And this is one of them. And the gym scene is another one of them. It's a completely unnecessary scene. Yeah. It gives absolutely nothing to the story, except that it just rounds out that notion that Clark Kent is a fool.
Yeah.
But it does allow us to see Christopher Reeve doing that kind of performance, which he is good at.
But is it worth the cost of the whole removing plot lines for the rest of the film for that?
Maybe
that
not.
That goes on for like
Maybe
10
not.
Minutes.
I don't know.
And they remove 10 minutes of footage.
The person who's responsible for the story and who has creative control over the movie is the person who shines in those two scenes.
So he can't bitch about his biography because...
Well, he does bitch about it, even though it's all on, maybe not all on him, but a lot of it is on him.
Now, I'm fine for suspending belief in these comic book movies. I understand it's reality, not reality and things like that. But can you explain to me how Lacey survived in space with no oxygen?
No. No, I cannot. Move on. Next.
What's going on? I will
defend this movie very broadly and say I enjoy watching it. But if you pick holes, there's not a lot I can say to that.
Yeah. I just felt, yeah. And he's Nuclear Man's death by being knocked into just the nuclear plant and having the door shut on him and then all the lights go bright is such a fucking anticlimax. It's just like, oh, that's it, you're dead. Oh, okay, that's fine. Like, kick him into the sun or, you know, doing something like that. Or like, I thought when they first take the... I like the scene where he takes the elevator and puts it on the dark side of the moon. What made no sense because then the light came there and I was like, but the light never comes to the dark side of the moon. So you could have just left him there. I mean, the end of the movie, it would have made sense. More than the sense that you made it, you know? Yeah. So that was my list of gripes. I'm not going to go. Okay. Some of them I'm not going to mention because I'm just like, we've kind of brushed on them before. But what are your likes in the movie, Claire?
No, I want to hear what you like. You say you've got one thing. What's the one thing that you like?
I like Christopher Reeve and Gene Hackman. You know, they're very good in these roles. I really enjoy both of them playing Clark Kent and Lex Luthor. I think they're great in them. I just think they've been... You know how I feel about this movie? This is how I feel towards this movie, how I felt when we went and watched The Flash this year. I felt like they took the GOAT of Superman, like with Michael Keaton, took the GOAT of Batman and put him in a mediocre movie and not something that he isn't worthy of being in. And that pisses me off.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel about this movie, how him being in this movie, that's how I felt Michael Keaton being in The Flash. Because every time I've seen Michael Keaton within The Flash, I was like, oh yeah, he's great. And then you're like, and he's just surrounded by all this other shit that is going on.
Yeah. But in this movie, the difference is that it was Christopher Reeve who put a lot of the shit there.
Yes, that is a very, very...
So it's kind of comes down onto him. But yes, I agree with you. And actually, that's kind of the crux of what I like in this movie. Putting aside the fact that I irrationally love this movie, I get that that's a completely irrational response from me to just go, well, I love it anyway. I can see it's a pile of shit, but I still enjoy it.
Yeah.
Looking at it critically, what I like in this movie is that all the things that we didn't like about Superman 3, the lack of Margot Kidder, or not enough of her in the movie. We see more of her in this movie. I could still take a bit more, but maybe I don't know how well she was when this movie was being made. She's not getting on very well with Christopher Reeve. But there's more of her. And I appreciate that there's more of her than there was in three. I appreciate that we have Gene Hackman back as Lex Luthor. He is much better for the franchise than Richard Pryor. I enjoyed Richard Pryor. He served a purpose in that movie, but it doesn't, you know, it's a very different kind of movie. I like, you know, there are comedic moments in Superman 4. There are bits that are amusing and funny, but it's not trying to be a comedy in the way that Superman 3 was. So that's what I kind of appreciate most objectively in this movie, is that all the things that we didn't like in Superman 3, they've gone back and gone, actually, no, we do need Gene Hackman. We do need the performances to be taking it seriously. Otherwise, the camp, I mean, maybe they didn't think they were being camp. Maybe it was just the 80s. But the reason the campness works for me is because it's being played straight. I think if you play too heavily the laughs, and we did see that a bit in Superman 3, it kind of stops being funny because you're like, it becomes incessant.
Yeah.
Whereas, and if you want a comedy movie, go watch a comedy. You know, you just said what, Beverly Hills Cop 2 was out in 1987.
Yeah.
If that's what I want, I'll go and watch that. If I'm watching Superman, I want a Superman movie. So I like that we've got that back. And yeah, I don't mind John Cryer. I think, I'm assuming, you know, they've hired him for a reason. They saw his other work, I presume, before hiring him. And if you're going to hire John Cryer, that's what you're going to get in the 80s. And
well, I think they're just trying to, I think by putting him in there, he was a massive teen star at the time. I think they're trying to appeal to a younger audience because a lot of people would have thought that Superman, the first Superman came out in 1979. So that's near enough 10 years different. So like you're looking at different age groups. They're trying to get younger people to come and watch this.
Yeah. Movie. So they're trying to get the kind of Pretty in Pink generation.
Yeah. And like, and also like superhero comic books, when we grew up, they're not big like they are now. Like it was seen as a geeky, unpopular.
It was a nerdy thing. It's kind of looped back round to being cool now. But in the 80s, it wasn't.
80s and 90s, people were just like, oh, you know, it wasn't popular to read comic books.
No.
So, taking that all into consideration, Claire, how many drag queen nuclear nails would you give Superman 4: The Quest for Peace?
You're going to balk at this, but I'm going to give this 3 out of 5. And I know that's ridiculous. I kind of know the movie doesn't deserve it.
Yeah.
But I enjoy, I don't know, I just something about it. It's that warm bowl of soup thing, isn't it? Like with the music.
Yeah.
But the whole film does that for me. It just seems very comforting, very familiar, very safe. Mm. I can't imagine myself ever going, oh, I'd really like to watch Superman 4 The Quest for Peace right now. But if it's on, if I'm channel hopping and it's there, or if I'm with someone who says, oh, I've never seen that, can we watch that? I would say, absolutely.
You say
yes,
that
let's
every
put it on.
Time you need to justify your score. That is your go-to line. If it's on TV, or if I'm with someone that wants to watch it, I won't turn it down. That is your go-to sentence. I'm going to get that on a T-shirt.
But that's my criteria.
I'm going to get that on a merch T-shirt for you to sell.
If I'm channel hopping and it's on, I'll watch it. 3 out of 5. That's my criteria for 3 out of 5. If that's how I feel about a movie, it gets a 3 from me. About you?
Well, seeing that this episode we're releasing on Thanksgiving, it kind of are we? Yes, we are. Are we?
Yeah.
Yes, we are. It's this, we are.
Yeah, I said we are. I didn't say we aren't. I don't know what Thanksgiving is. I'm agreeing with you. Yeah, because it's Black Friday next week, isn't it?
Yes. So, we'll see. It's overstuffed. This film is overstuffed. It's overstuffed how I will feel on Thanksgiving. It's overstuffed. I feel like I went into it with an appetite and came out unpleasantly comfortable. That's like a good meal. So taking that in order...
You need to loosen your belt and go to the bathroom.
Yeah. I'm going to give it 2 out of 5 just for the sake of having Christopher Reeves and Gene Hackman back on the screen for a last hoo-ha, shall I say. But apart from that, the story, the directing, Nuclear Man, they don't get any points from me. It's just one part for Christopher Reeves or one point for Gene Hackman. That is 2 out of 5.
So that's Superman 4, The Quest for Peace for you. Listeners, please take a moment to rate us and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any new episodes. And tell us what you thought of the movie. You can leave us a comment, you can email us on unlovedsequels@gmail.com, and you'll find us on all the socials at @unlovedsequels.
So it's goodbye from me, Michael.
And from me, Claire.
Take care, guys. Bye.